Hey, welcome to episode 305. We finally, after years of waiting, all the buildup, we talked to Scott Stapp of Creed. With arms wide open. Man, we did an hour. I'd never met Scott Stapp before, but was a huge Creed fan back in the day. And so, I mean, we've been talking about getting him forever, huh?
Yeah, we have.
He came in, he could not have been nicer.
Yeah, I think one of the few times I've been like starstruck, kind of.
Yeah, he walks in and he sits down and I'm just like, dang. Like I'm sitting 6 feet away from Scott Stapp.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's an hour long. We didn't know. Sometimes people come in and it isn't flowing how we had hoped, or I'm having a bad day, or they're having a bad day, and it goes 20, 30 minutes. But with Scott, he was so open, and it was an hour long. And he didn't do many interviews, so pretty proud of this, that I got to talk with him for an hour. So, I mean, he talks about it all, that their unheard-of rise to fame, how they got a record deal, which was weird, meaning everybody wanted them, then nobody wanted them, how he dealt with being called the most hated band in America, you know, finding peace in his family. All that's coming up. Just, I love this episode. I hope you guys love it too. Before we get into the interview, the new music top five for the week, the Kid LAROI and Justin Bieber have a new song called Stay. Here it is. When I'm away from you, I miss your touch. You're the reason I believe in love. Number four, Zac Brown Band released two new songs. One is called Out in the Middle, and this one is called Old Love Song. Stand by me, darling, you keep me free falling when you say nothing at all. Girl, put your records on. Let me love you like an old love song. Some of that classic Zac Brown Band there. And number three, Post Malone has a new song out called Motley Crue. What you gonna do? I'ma pull up with the crew. When I'm off the juice, I like to hang out the roof. And number two, Lauren Jenkins has an EP out called Miles on Me Part 1. Here is a new song called She's a Star. She's a star. And my number one new release of the week is Kaylee Shore. She has a new song out called Love Child. She also has a podcast you can check out called Too Much to Say.
Too
Much to Say with Kaylee Shore. I was going to say So Much to Say, but that's a Dave Matthews Band song. Do you know that? So much to say, so much. What?
I don't know that song.
So much to say, so much to say. Nothing?
Nothing.
Dang. In quick music news, Mark Chestnut cancels concerts to have back surgery. So if you're going to go watch Mark Chestnut and a little 90s country tour, won't be having it. Hopefully he gets better soon. HBO Max drops a trailer for the Woodstock 99 documentary. HBO Max is doing the new documentary premiering on July 23rd, Woodstock 99, Peace, Love, and Rage, about how that didn't go that well.
Yeah, looks crazy.
Looks, if I were comparing it, the analogy is sort of Firefest?
Basically.
In a different way?
Yeah, total destruction.
Yes, but it just didn't go as planned.
Yeah.
I guess that would be, and Scott Stapp's got a little part in that.
He does.
With Creed and the band. Korn, Limp Bizkit, Chili Peppers, Rage, Kid Rock, Metallica, Dave, Alanis, Insane Clown Posse. Those were all people that were there, and it turned into an absolute
burning
absolute
stuff.
Yeah. Like, people seemed more upset than they should be. Like, they got mad for no reason. You're at a concert. Let's see. Billie Eilish's brother Phineas was the number one songwriter on Spotify in 2020. XXXTentacion. How do you say that?
Yeah.
That's right.
That's right.
I listened to the podcast about him on the
Disgraceland.
Yeah. By the way, which is a good podcast here when he came in here. But that's interesting because he's not alive anymore.
No.
Wasn't a good dude.
No.
Not at all. Bruno Mars, Ariana Grande are banned in Indonesia. I think that's it, huh?
Yeah.
I'd ban a few songs from our airwaves if I could.
What would you ban?
Yeah. Not for
just
here.
Just a few?
Not for here and today. There's some real turds on the radio right now, though. I'll be honest with you. Okay. That's what's up. We'll do this, and then we will come back with an hour with Scott Stapp of Creed. Let's play a few Creed clips, by the way.
All right.
Just before we get into it here. What do you have? Do you have My Own Prison?
I do.
Here you go. Coming in there on Sunday morning, man, my hair. Come on. Do you have What's This Life For? Come on. Do you have With Arms Wide Open? Yeah. Do you have Can You Take Me Higher? Yeah. Do you have One? What else you have over there?
They got One Last Breath.
And I'm thinking. Okay, what else?
My Sacrifice.
Oh. Me. I'm free. Yeah, I sing good too. Yeah. Man, walk down memory lane. There you go. Scott Stapp, Creed. That's coming up. All right, with Scott Stapp of Creed, and most of the time when friends come over, they're friends and they're buddies, and I'm like, hey, let's do this because they're promoting something or it's a fun conversation. But rarely do I get to have someone in that I've been a genuine fan of for 20 years. And so, like, I'm grateful that you took the time to come over here and hang out and let me talk with you because, again, I'm a fan and it's rare for me to get to talk to someone in that capacity.
Man, thank you. That means a lot. Bro, thank you. And it's awesome to be here. And, you know, people have been trying to get us together for a while.
Well, it's mostly been me going, come on!
I've been getting text messages and whatnot. And so it's awesome, man. We're neighbors, bro.
You drove up and I didn't. You'd lived in Nashville for over 5 years at this point.
Yeah, coming up on six, yeah.
I was talking to Brad from Three Doors Down.
Yep.
And I said, hey, I saw you on Instagram with Scott Stapp. And I know Brad. Brad's come out and he's done my radio show. We've played a couple things together. He's played charity events with my band.
Yeah.
And I was like, will you tell Scott Stapp I'm a good guy? Like, I was like, if you go to dinner with him, just put in the word that I just want to say hello.
Right.
But I saw you guys maybe at like a baseball game or something in town.
It was my son's baseball team, and he came out. And I've known Brad since like 1998. And you know, we weren't, you know, we didn't stay in touch the entire time, but we recently reconnected and, love him. And he texts me like from, you know, I think here
from
wherever you guys were. He's like, dude, I'm right here with Bobby. He, you know, and he sent me a message and I was like, man, all right, I've got to do something with Bobby.
Hopefully good stuff. Hopefully it's that good
all
stuff.
All good. I've heard nothing but amazing things about you, bro. And everyone who's shot me a message has told me, you know, that you were a fan of the music and it was a positive thing. And I haven't been trying to avoid you, I promise.
Well, I was such a fan, and I want to tell you my one Scott Stapp Creed story.
All right.
It's a good story, except I'm embarrassed. I was like 19, it was like maybe 99 or 2000, and you're just a few years older than I am, so you must have been like 25 or something like that, mm-hmm. 24, 25. You guys had sold out the arena in Little Rock, Arkansas, and that's where I'm from, Central Arkansas.
Right.
And Creed was coming through, I was freaking pumped. And I was working at a radio station, and I was, it was that part of my career where I was like, man, if I can get backstage, all I want to do is say hi to Scott Stapp. That was my goal. And so I'm back in the backstage area, and what people don't realize, and you know too, backstage is really not that glamorous.
Right.
There's a place for some pictures.
Right.
But it's not like the band hangs out backstage. Mostly it's in the bus.
Right.
And so, were you a ping pong player?
We played ping pong backstage.
So
yeah.
I played
we had some tournaments.
With you.
You did.
One point. So I'm back there and I'm just like, man, I just want any time to see Scott Stapp. And so you come walking in, you were just chill. You just walked in the room and I was like, oh my God. And you went, does anyone play ping pong? And I didn't, but I was like, this is my shot. And I was like, I play ping, and I didn't play ping pong at all. I was like, I play ping pong. And we got up and we played, and you were up 8-0, and you go, does anybody else play ping pong? That was it. And I was like, it was equally embarrassing and awesome at the same time, because you beat me 8-0, then somebody else stepped up from the crew.
Man. Right.
But
right.
I remember you were just whooping me, and I could see the look on your face like, this guy, he lied. He does not play ping pong.
We had some intense ping pong tournaments back in the day between the bandmates and with, you know, the traveling show that we were. So we were into it, man. And so hope I wasn't too competitive with you.
Oh, it was wonderful because it's the greatest story. Had it been 8-3, that's not a good story. But 8-0, where you whooped me and then we're like, okay, I need a real player. Like, that's the best story. Like, I recently got to play golf with Jordan Spieth,
right,
who is one of the best golfers in the world right now.
Right, right.
And he beat me so bad and took all my money. I was like, this is the greatest outcome for me because you are Jordan Spieth to me. You're like the greatest and you whooped me real good.
Oh, man. What a story.
Well, so
good times.
I was kind of looking back at some of the older, in our younger days, whenever you guys got together, and there's a big Florida State presence in the band.
Right.
Because that's where you guys met to begin with, right?
Yes, yes.
And so you go to Florida State, and what was your idea when you go to college? Like, what did you want to be when you went to Florida State? Because a lot of people don't go to Florida State to go, I want to be in a band and be a big star.
Right. Well, I mean, I'll be honest with you. The only reason that I left Orlando to go to Tallahassee and to end up going to school at Florida State was because I was reading a biography about the Doors and read that Jim Morrison, whom I was a huge fan of and a huge fan of the Doors, went to Florida State. And in my naive 18 or 19-year-old mind at the time, I thought, well, hey, I mean, that's just the way that you meet musicians and start a band. And
so it was about music.
Yeah. And so I went there with the specific goal of meeting musicians to start a band. And that was the goal.
Did you 100%. Have a major?
Well, I did. It was communications and minor in English. And like, I think I had like 3 or 4 minors because I kept changing my major. Like, I think it started out as like philosophy and so I got a lot of minors and you know, my backup plan, which I didn't really focus on too much, was I was going to go to law school, and do that.
Were you a smart kid?
I did okay in school. Yeah, I did. I don't know if I was smart, but I studied and did well.
Take me to like sixth grade, Scott. Like when you're in sixth grade and you're there, like, all right, what do you want to be when you grow up? Because you kind of start around sixth, seventh grade to figure out what your bones are about.
Right.
Like, what did you want to do at 12, 13 years old?
I wanted to be a Major League Baseball player.
Did you have the genetic build, the work ethic? Did you have that kind of at 12, 13 where you're already advanced?
At baseball?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I practiced every day. And did well. And I was a jock, man, believe it or not. I sang, I performed at school, at my church, and, you know, even wrote lyrics and poetry and whatnot. But then my focus, though, was baseball and basketball. And I put hours and hours and hours into both of those sports.
When did that dream pivot into music?
Well, my senior year, I had got some scholarship offers and did some school visits. And believe it or not, Vanderbilt was one of the schools that
had. So you had Division I school saying, hey, you should come play ball here.
Had recruited me, yeah.
Wow.
And I remember me and my father came up and met with a coach here, did a tour of the school. And so, you know, I think it was my destiny to end up in Nashville. Because I think, and also to be in music, because I think my philosophically and spiritually, I think my life path was to go to Nashville then. And I think, believe it or not, that everything still would have happened, maybe in a different way. But some things happened and I ended up, not coming to Vandy and going to, a school in Cleveland, Tennessee, called Lee College, and they were going to start a baseball team. They had a basketball team.
So you were still going to play ball, though?
Yeah, I was gonna walk on their basketball team and then play on their baseball team. And then that didn't work out. I tried some things at a Christian college that you're not supposed to do, and so they asked me to take a break. That's a nice way of saying getting kicked out.
We had a Christian school across the street from where I went to school, and if you were like, if you had a picture of you with a beer, they would suspend you.
Right.
Was it a similar type environment there?
It was a very similar environment, and I was a very very naive and young, and just being an 18-year-old and being an 18-year-old in college, and anyway, so ended up back in Orlando. My baseball dreams were gone, but I still had this passion for music that was always there. It was like both of them were in me. I had just focused on sports and school, and the singing was just something to do for fun. And so I really began to kind of swell up in me, and become something that, hey, you know, I want to do this. And I remember going to a couple concerts and seeing the bands and going, I just believed in my head, I can do that.
Were you in a high school band of any sort?
No.
So you just knew you wanted to do it. You had just focused all on your athletic career though.
Yeah. At that time. Yeah.
So you're back in Orlando. Okay. When do you go to Tallahassee?
I read a book. I was working at a restaurant. I was a cook, short order cook, going to community college. And something always in me said, I need to stay in school. You know, so I didn't give up school yet. So I was doing that, and then I read a book after I was introduced to the Doors by the movie, and just became infatuated with that band and their whole persona and how Jim Morrison approached lyric writing and just fell in love with that whole concept and wanted that. U2 was another band that I in younger life. Fell in love with and just really felt inspired by and loved how the songs made me feel, how they were written lyrically, the Joshua Tree album in particular. And so with those two influences, and once I decided that, hey, this is what I want to do, when I read that, Morrison went to Florida State and was in Tallahassee, I was naive and I thought, hey, there must be a lot of musicians there. and that's where I need to be to start a band and chase my rock and roll dreams.
I was watching a clip of Jim Morrison a couple weeks ago, and mid to late 70s when computers and music, that wasn't a thing. They didn't mix at all. And he was doing an interview on one of those talk shows, and he was like, you know, I can see it now. He goes, you guys don't think I'm crazy, but you're going to be making music with computers. And it's going to be, he was so out, and he was out in front of everything.
Yeah.
Like, not by steps, but by miles.
Yeah.
And he's like, you don't see it now. He goes, we're nowhere close to it, but I can see in generations, a couple to a few, computers literally will be making the music that we're doing right here with our hands.
Uh-huh.
And they thought he was absolutely bonkers.
Yeah.
And he was, but that made him also, like, so smart, so different.
Right. I mean, he was a visionary and thought outside the box, and that definitely shined through. In their music and in his gift. And unfortunately, they didn't get to continue. But he definitely inspired me and Bono inspired me to chase these dreams.
You get to Florida State.
Yeah.
You want to do music.
Yeah.
But how the heck do you start, doing music? Like, when do you meet Mark? What did that went on that?
Literally, I went around and handmade little flyers. I want to, looking for a band, looking for a guitar player, called this number, and was putting them up on campus. And then a friend of mine who I went to high school with, she went to school at Florida State. And I was connecting with a couple people that I knew in high school. And she said, Mark's here. Mark Tremonti's here and he plays guitar. And I said, you know what? I remember that. I remember going to like one of the only two parties that I snuck out of my house and went to. Because I wasn't allowed to do that. I remember coming out of a kitchen and walking by a sliding glass door to outside and seeing some dude sitting outside alone playing acoustic guitar. And I remember opening the door and looking outside and going, hey, you're Mark Tremonti, right? And he goes, yeah. And I go, you play guitar? And he goes, yeah. And I go, I sing. And he goes, cool, man. And that was it. Because he was a junior and I was a senior. And that was the only, because we weren't like buddies in high school, but we knew of each other. And that was our only interaction in high school was that moment. And then, you know, fast forward years later, he had gone to Clemson University and then transferred, you know, over to Florida State. And then we get introduced again through a mutual friend. And I think because we went to the same high school and had some mutual friends that we felt comfortable around each other. And I was so excited, man, to find someone to jam with. That he's, I remember sitting down with him and he's just shredding all these metal licks and playing all the stuff that I really didn't know a lot about at the time, but I didn't care. I was like, it's awesome. It's awesome. Let's write songs. And we sat down and shared all these ideas. And I think we probably came up with like 20 ideas in the first like 3 hours we had sat down with each other. And then it just started from there, and we decided, hey, let's do this. Let's start a band.
So what does that mean? Because you're going to start a band. Do you go out and do you play for anybody, just you two? Like, do you go to a coffee shop? Do you?
Well, we kept getting together and just jamming.
Did he think you were good?
I don't know. You know, I hope so. I think we had a mutual admiration for each other. I know he saw, because he commented before, you know, he saw my passion. You know, he saw how committed I was, how much lyrics I was writing and poetry that I was writing and how passionate I was about getting together to rehearse and write. And so, yeah, you know, I definitely think so. I think we inspired each other. I saw his passion and his playing moved me and brought... It was like it was a muse. It brought things out of me, and I think that energy began to share with, you know, was shared with each other. I would inspire him, and it just became this mutual admiration for each other eventually. And then, you know, we had to find a bass player and a drummer, and so we eventually did. We found Brian and Scott Phillips. Brian was actually playing in a cover band, a pretty successful college cover band that was like playing gigs every weekend.
He was making money.
Making money, you know. And, you know, we kind of stole him from that gig. And that was a big thing. We were like trying to recruit him. And he was like, man, you know, I got this good thing going and I'm making money, you know, and you guys aren't even playing out. Like you're just, you know, jamming and Scott's singing through Mark's amp, same amp that he's playing guitar from. And finally, we got him. We had this one bass player. This is hilarious. I can't remember his name. My mind wants to tell me his name was Kearns. Okay. So anyone out there listening, if you remember, you know, shoot me a text or call in or whatever, but he didn't play. He just stood there and pretended to play.
So he wasn't a real bass player.
We couldn't tell because he didn't have an amp or he had an amp, but it was just the way we were rehearsing. It was like maybe he did play a note here or there during rehearsals, but we eventually realized when we would have our friends come over and, you know, and we were playing original songs and coming up with ideas that me and Mark were writing, he wasn't even playing bass. He was just standing there trying to look cool. and so we eventually, it's a funny Spinal Tap kind of story, like, you know, this stand-in bass player that just, you know, he would rock and move and, you know, look like he was playing, but like nothing. And maybe we realized that at our first gig. I think Mark came to me
He actually got to a gig not playing.
Got to a gig. Yeah, like nice. He fooled us just long enough to get to like one gig, I believe, if my memory serves me. And then Mark came to me afterwards and he goes, dude, Kearns didn't play the entire night. And I was like, what? And, you know, so we let him go and you know, eventually got Brian and Scott and man, really we were just kind of a, you know, jam. Scott Phillips had this cool little rental house that he rented while he was going to school and working and it had this outdoor concrete like garage, but I don't even know, it was almost like a basement, but it was like outdoors and separate from the house, just a solid concrete room, and we would go out there and just jam and write and rehearse, but we never played out. And so finally, we began to play out.
Where'd you get your first gig?
I believe it was a place called Yanni's.
And what is
if I remember correctly, not it was either Yanni's or oh man, no, it wasn't Yanni. I'm trying to remember.
Did you have a name then?
We went through a couple. We went through a few names. I mean, we didn't really have a definitive name. I mean, we had some stupid ideas. I mean, Backbone. I mean, you know, how cool is that, right?
But if Backbone would have been the name and had been a hit, we'd have been like, that's normal.
And then we had this crazy name that you know, Mark had this idea, and he goes, I've always had this idea for a band name. And he pulls out this newspaper article from his wallet, and it said Naked Toddler, da-da-da-da-da-da. And he had always, and he thought Naked Toddler would be a killer band name. And literally, man, he carried the article in his wallet. And he pulls it out. So we're like, all right, let's be Naked Toddler. And so we went and played a gig, and they had Naked Toddler on the billboard. Didn't go over too well. A lot of people didn't show up. I think the name kind of...
I think
kinda,
if I was going to show up, I may have not because
kinda,
of Naked Toddler.
Kind of scared them. But you know, no one was really showing up to see us anyway. We were really just like playing at bars, you know, playing covers, throwing in, you know, an original here or there, just trying to figure out our sound and our style. And so eventually, Brian Marshall, our bass player, he came and he said, you know, I used to be in a band called Maddox Creed. And when he said that, I instantly gravitated to the word creed, you know, being the lyricist and you know, writing the songs that it just fit with how I was writing and the songs that Mark and I were creating and the lyrics that I was coming up with. And I go, let's keep the Creed part, man. I love that. And so we all agreed, and Creed became the name. And then we continued to play out. I think we played out at a place called Big Daddy's, Yanni's. There was another club there that like all the you know, regional traveling bands, you know, Butch Walker, who's a big producer now, he was in a band, and I can't remember their band name, but he eventually, it was Marvelous Three, but he was in one prior to that, and we used to go see them all the time, and Butch was such an amazing performer, so charismatic, And so I remember watching him going, man, I want to bring that energy to what I do. I was inspired by him. And then John Hopkins, who went on to be a founding member of, what's the band name? Big Country Act. I can't believe it just slipped my mind.
Mike D will find. He will fact check that.
Right. But John Hopkins was playing with a friend, and they were acoustic. He inspired me, too. There was a lot of great musicians and artists, that went on to have, pretty successful, careers, in the, entertainment business. You know, Butch Walker's a famous producer now, and John Hopkins, if you Google him.
Is it Zach Brown Band?
Zach Brown Band, that's right. Co-founder of Zach Brown Band. And he was a solo artist at the time. So that was the scene. And then Sister Hazel was coming through, and the owners of the bar, the owners of one of the bars that we played at was a co-manager of Sister Hazel, or knew their manager. There was some connection there. And so he came to us, his name was Jeff Hansen, and he said, hey, I want to manage you guys. Do you have a CD? And we were like, no. And he goes, well, he hooked us up with this local engineer producer who was kind of a regional star, 10, 15 years earlier, named John Kerswig. And we put in $100 a week or $50 a week and started recording.
Was that My Own Prison the first
time? That was My Own Prison, yeah.
And you guys did that, and again, I'm just going to be a fan for a second, and I may be a fan slightly wrong, but you guys did that on such a budget. Were like $5,000-$7,000 for that whole record, right?
Right. It ended up costing that much, and I believe we borrowed the difference in what we needed from Brian Marshall's dad.
You borrowed money.
But we were putting in money ourselves, but I think I can't remember exactly, but we borrowed money to get it pressed, like to buy our first run of CDs and also finish the project. And
how old were you at this time?
I want to say 22, 23, somewhere in the, probably 23 when we got that finished.
So you finished it with, listen, it takes $6,000 a cut now, right? If you're going to do a real record, it takes about $6,000.
Right, right.
You finished the whole thing for, we'll say roughly $6,000. Whenever you gave it to him or gave it to people, were they like, wow, this is amazing?
We started getting that reaction, and the local radio station started playing My Own Prison.
Oh, that's my jam, too.
Yeah, on the Locals Only show. And then another station in Thomasville, Georgia, started playing another song off the record called Pity for a Dime. That was their single. And we started getting noticed from, you know, the L.A. and New York record companies when My Own Prison went number one at the Tallahassee rock station and Pity for a Dime went number one at the Thomasville, Georgia rock station. And then we got, I think we got like 10,000 CDs printed.
Were you still paying for that, the 10,000 CDs, or did somebody hop?
Well, I think that was part of the $6,000.
Got it. Okay, so when you paid for all of it, you had 10,000 CDs. Got it.
Right, right. I think the $6,000 encompassed not only making the record, but also getting the first 10,000 pressing, I believe.
How fast were they selling?
Well, we invented a record company called Blue Collar Records, and our managers and some friends of ours would go to the record stores as Blue Collar Records representatives. because we wanted to get them to sell our CDs. And so we put them in the stores, and we sold all 10,000 CDs in the first 4 weeks.
Wow.
And that's when the label started coming to Tallahassee, because that, you know, it flagged on their sound scan. You know, who is this band that sold, you know, 10,000 albums last month? And so, you know, that's when it started.
So I'm going to take one step back.
Yeah, because
I am curious about the how you guys blew up, but I'm always curious in how it started and kind of the genesis of songwriting. If you had never written music and you've written, I mean, I listed all the massive songs, basically everything. I have songwriter friends that have been doing it their whole life, have written a hit, and they're really good. You hadn't done it at all.
Right.
And then you started writing songs, and you have so many. Like, how easily, or was it not easy, for you to start writing songs that actually were good, catchy songs with hooks?
You know, I think we wrote probably 7 or 8 songs that, you know, in trying to find our sound. And then we wrote a song called Grip My Soul, which never made a record. Should have, but it didn't make the record. We didn't record it. Or maybe we did record it, but it didn't make the record. That might have been our 8th or 9th song. And I remember when we wrote that song, we all looked at each other, and Mark and I specifically, and we're like, okay, we got it. We figured, this is it. We figured it out. And from that moment on, what you hear on My Prison was written. Literally only probably once we figured out what our sound was, from Grip My Soul to what was recorded on My Own Prison, we probably only wrote 14 songs.
Wow.
And total, since Mark and I were together, maybe 20 songs.
Which is a very low number.
Were the first 20 songs I had ever written in my life.
And that's my point exactly. Like, I have friends that have been doing it for 20 years. They write 60 songs for a record now.
The only thing I can think of, man, is that you know, the artists that I listen to, you know, being U2, also, you know, growing up listening, you know, the only thing that was allowed in my home growing up was Christian rock or Christian artists. And so, you know, I would listen to a lot of Take Six, and I think that's who taught me how to sing, because I would sing along with those records and sing every vocal part on that record. And then DC Talk, which became Toby Mac.
Yeah.
That was allowed in my house. And then U2, because the same thing that people ended up doing with Creed that were in Christian homes, saying, wait, they're a Christian band, mom and dad, even though Creed wasn't an official Christian band, just like U2 is not a Christian band, but Bono's a Christian. And so I snuck Joshua Tree got it into my house and was able to listen to that by telling my parents that they were a Christian band. But I think those bands that I listened to growing up, Striper was another one that was a jam in my house. But I think all that was just imprinted in my brain. I think song structure and how to write songs based on those records was just imprinted in my brain. Mark the same way. Mark was, he was much more, he was much different than me in that Mark knew what he wanted to do when he was probably 10 or 11 years old. Mark knew he wanted to be in a rock band, play guitar and write songs and be a singer and a guitar player. He knew. At least that's how I recall it. And so he knew all these bands that I had never heard of. He probably knew hundreds and hundreds of songs on guitar, you know, by learning them on tab and just listening and playing them. So of course that taught him song structure and taught him. So I think me just hearing that in him, I think we just inherently knew structure and how to put a song together. And then it just came out once we got together. We didn't think too much about it. We never sat down and thought, let's write a radio song or we need to do this. We were just like, hey, that's the verse, that's the chorus, that's this. We never put any pressure on ourselves. We just wrote what made us feel good. Because in the beginning, we were just playing for us. You know what I mean?
My Own Prison. I'm going to play a few of these hooks here. Here is actually My Own Prison, 1997. Yeah, whenever I hear a song from like when I feel like I felt then. Music does that.
Right.
Like when you hear a song that reminds you of a really big part of your life, you for a second you feel that part of your life again.
Yeah, yeah.
And this record does that to me. This is the record in general. Torn. Here's a clip of Torn. What's This Life For? Which was a rock number one for you guys.
Yep.
Was this a big separator for you guys? Did this one turn you guys from a national known band to like a, whoa, here they come?
I think, you know, My Own Prison went, all four of our first singles went number one at rock. And I think it was a build. And then, you know, My Own Prison was our first video that was on MTV and VH1. And then What's This Life For? I think was our second video that was on MTV and VH1. And it was more of a, it had more of a appeal to a wider audience. What's This Life For did, I think.
That's when I felt other people were knowing about you guys.
Right.
When What's This,
right.
Because the Edge Dallas, I would have a friend record, take a cassette tape, because kids now don't know.
Yeah.
You do record, play, pause, and then you undo pause.
Right.
And you record what's on the radio.
Right.
And I'd have a friend send it to me. And he was like, you got to hear Creed, What's This Life For? I remember, I was like, I already been knowing about Creed.
Right.
But I felt like that song.
Yeah, I definitely think that just, you know, expanded it even further. And I think the video had a lot to do with that, too. And I think it was really palatable, you know, to a wider audience. And I think we began to see our audience by the time What's This Life For? And then once One, the song One became a single and had its time, our audience really expanded from. And was a mix of men and women. And initially, it was just, you know, dudes, based on our first two singles, you know, into heavy, you know, heavy, aggressive rock. But those two songs showed a different side of the band and began to really open up our audience. And then, you know, the next record, you know, with Higher. And
did you feel the rocket ship? For the first record, you make it, you don't spend a lot of money on it, but you're hustling, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got fake representatives going to record stores.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you are in the hustle.
Right.
Do you feel the rocket ship, or do you just realize, oh boy, we're on it now?
We expected it. We were so, or at least I did. I had this blind confidence, and I had these blinders on, and I just thought that it was going to happen. I just had such belief in the music that we were creating. And then once we made the CD, and then once the record label started coming down, I just thought that, hey, here it is. We're going to be playing arenas soon. That's what happens. That's what happens when you get a record deal and you get on the radio. You play arenas. I had no idea that was only the beginning. And the chances of you, you know, even making it past your first single were slim to none. You know, I was so naive. But I think that was actually a benefit to me at the time, because it took away any fear or doubt or anything that could stand in the way of me, you know, achieving and giving what I needed to give from my standpoint to make it happen. And I think it was contagious to the guys in the band. And we all just had this belief in what we were doing, and we didn't think it would turn out any other way.
With you guys having your music already made and knowing who you were as a band, did that make your first deal easier to actually know what you wanted and not get ripped off?
Well, here's another funny story, or not funny story, but we almost didn't have a record deal. We had literally every major label interested, and then one by one, they started bowing out.
Because?
Don't know. They just, they're interested, they're down, they're talking with our managers, their meetings, they're talking with our big New York lawyer that we had, that got everybody signed, you know. And one by one, they would bail. And then it came down to Atlantic Records and the two Knicks that we were talking to. And we were in their offices, meetings, New York, back, and we were 100% sure that you know, it was going to be Atlantic Records. And, you know, negotiations were going on, the whole nine yards. I think they ended up signing a band instead of us called 7 Mary 3.
And Cumbersome, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we were like, oh my God, what are we going to do?
Why was everybody dropping? Do you know?
I have no idea. And then this little company, never signed a band before. A woman named Diana Meltzer and her husband, Alan Meltzer, they had just started a label called Wind Up Records. And somehow, I think through our lawyer, our Blue Collar Records CD got in Diana Meltzer's hands, and she heard it, and she was 100% convinced that she had to sign this band. She had to sign this band. So she told her husband, Alan, I'm going to Tallahassee, and I'm signing this band, whether you come with me or not. He came. He ended up listening to the CD. He loved it. They came. You know, it was so funny. I remember looking in the crowd, and, you know, there wasn't that many people there at that particular time. They looked like they were in the mafia. You know, there was this little guy in an all black suit, you know, New York looking guy, and his wife in all black. And we were like, whoa, who are these two mafia people in the crowd? And they were standing in the center, and they were just rocking out, you know. Our managers came and said, there's some record company folks that want to meet with you guys afterwards. So we went to this bar next door, and it had like a rooftop bar, and we went up there and we talked, and they said, we want to sign you. And this is right after we had, you know, been basically passed on by everybody else, and we had no other option. And looking back, it was the greatest thing that could ever happen to us, because this man was a very successful businessman, and he was starting a new business, and we got all the attention from his company, and he did not want to fail, and he was a gambler. We didn't learn that till later on in life, that he was a gambler, but he put all his resources into the band. But again, we had no other option, so we took it, and you know, again, naive, but he knew what he was doing. And so we signed with little Wind Up Records, the engine that could, the rest is history.
Did you guys make any money off the first record after signing with them because it did so well?
Yeah, money started coming in. Yeah. I mean, we didn't have a very good deal. It was a bad deal.
What about your publishing from writing the song? Did you get paid from that differently?
We got paid. No, we got publishing, got recording, we got royalties. We just got a tiny advance and just probably, you know, your basic crappy record deal that was probably pretty standard in 1997. You know, I mean, our publishing deal, we still owned, you know, the vast majority of our publishing, of course, and then had the typical, probably standard record deal. But the record, you know, went 6 times platinum, I believe. And so we definitely, you know, recouped because they used our demo, man. They
just used the record you spent $6,000 on.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we had nothing to recoup except, you know, the couple music videos and maybe some tour support early on. And so, yeah, you know, our lives changed really quick, you know.
What is that like? You talk about a rocket ship when your lives change so quickly.
Yeah.
Do you go crazy or are you scared?
It was happening so fast, and it was so awesome, and it was such a high and so exciting, and our dreams were coming true. We were just enjoying every minute of it, man, without the thought of it could ever end, you know? We were just caught up in it.
Did you guys get a plane?
Eventually, yeah. After Human Clay, we had a plane. We had a G5.
Oh, come on.
You know, I mean, yeah, man. I mean, it
But went, Human Clay was so big.
It yeah,
like,
man.
It was next level. Like, yeah. when Higher comes out, boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
I mean, just that drum part and you singing, like, that to me personifies that whole, like, year 2000, like, time period in music.
Yeah.
I mean, Higher was set, and here's, we'll play a clip of Higher in case you've been living under a rock, or you're 12, could be 12.
Right,
listening
right.
to this. Was this another level for you guys with
yep.
the song?
Yeah, this took us to another level. It took us higher, pun intended. And then, you know, there was another song on this record, What If, that was tied in with the Scream 3 movie. And so we did a video with all the Scream 3, you know, actors, and that also, you know, to have that title track for a soundtrack and the whole movie machine behind that gave us exposure to, you know, another greater portion of the world, and then Higher, and then, you know, and then the grand slam that just took it, you know, to the stratosphere was Arms Wide Open, which came later.
I remember vividly that heartbeat, and I don't know if it was a radio version or the album version, but it would be like,
yeah.
And then, well, I just heard that. That heartbeat still sits with me, like, doop. When that song comes out, because that was a number one pop song, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's you beating everybody.
Right.
Again, it had to be just another notch of what is happening with our life right now.
We were in it and enjoying it. And just living it, and like I said earlier, we, or at least I, let me just speak for me. I thought that's what was supposed to happen to a band when they got a record deal and got on the radio. I didn't realize until years later that that's not what happens to every band that gets a record deal and gets on the radio. But in that moment, I did. So I thought everything that was happening was just what was supposed to happen. You know what I mean?
What would you go back and tell that kid, though, now?
Oh, man, I could tell that kid a lot. man, appreciate the people around you. Let them know, even though you may appreciate them, let them know on a regular basis. You know, I was so caught up in, you know, I had a lot of anxiety. That's one issue that I dealt with, you know, and so every day that we had a big show in front of an arena crowd or wherever, you know, I was nervous all day long. And so I would kind of isolate myself because I was just nervous and didn't want to mess up and whatnot. And so I would tell that guy, hey, chill, man, and just appreciate the people around you more and let them know, you know, and I did periodically, but I would do more. Also spend more time nurturing all the relationships that you make in this business. You know, I was so caught up in what I had to do and in Creed and in writing the songs and, you know, that I think this peripheral things I didn't pay enough attention to that, you know, as a more mature human being now, I realize are so important. I mean, it takes a team. You know, it wasn't just the band that was doing everything. It's the team. And so, you know, I think I would definitely, and also I would have told myself, you know, to look at it. This is a job too. You know what I mean? And it's not just one big party. It's, you know, and so definitely, have a lot of things to say to my younger self, about relationships, about taking care of myself mentally and physically, and just appreciating every moment and the people around me. Like I said, and preserving and nurturing, those relationships despite what I was going through, at the time.
Would you get nervous when a record would come out? Because, you know, My Own Prison, probably not, because you hustled. But then after it's a success and Human Clay is about to come out, or Weather is about to come out, are you like, well, we got to beat the last one? Or are you just going, let's just go, fire them off?
We were in such a rapid motion from making a record, promoting singles, tour, right back in the studio. We wrote Human Clay on tour because we only had like 10 or 11 songs to play. And so we were like, we got to write some more songs. So we were playing, you know, Say I and Faceless Man and some other songs off of Human Clay, eventually Arms Wide Open, and probably even Higher, live prior to recording them on the album. And so, you know, we kind of would see how the fans would react. You know, they were getting positive reactions. And so we weren't thinking about failure. We never thought about that. Looking back, we just were so focused on what we were doing in that moment, and the doubt didn't come in. We didn't set any expectations on ourselves.
With Arms Wide Open, written about your son.
Yes, it was inspired when I found out I was going to be a father for the first time. Yeah,
is he an adult now?
Yes.
Wild. Like, that's when, yeah, I'm like, how old am I? Yeah. It's one of those moments where you're like, well, yeah, crap.
Well, it's funny that you know, my other three children, they all know the song, and it's kind of, you know, it's a family song now. It's for all of you. You know what I mean? It's just inspired by your big brother, but it's for you too. You know,
when you play dates now, when you're doing solo dates, which, by the way, August 5th in St. Charles, Illinois, August 6th in Mankato, Minnesota, August 14th in Carlton, Minnesota. Do you do all the Creed songs?
I do a lot of them. Yeah, I do. I pretty much do like a solo song, a Creed song, a solo song, a Creed song. So because, you know, the fans that are there started out with me liking Creed. And, you know, I want to give them, I'm there to entertain and give the fans what they want. And I still enjoy playing those songs. I love them. And so it feels good to play them, and it's great to be able to mix that up with my solo material, and you know, the fans have responded well to that.
Your latest project, The Space Between the Shadows.
Yeah.
Whenever you are making a solo record, like, what are you seeing differently than when you would make a collaborative record with the band? Like, how are you approaching that creative? And how did you, because that's got to be a big creative change when you first started doing your solo project.
Yeah.
Like, what was different in your mind and in your creative process?
Well, I mean, the creative process with Creed was primarily Mark and I would go away alone and write the songs and then come back and jam them with the band. And so I just, that's the only way that I knew how to write, you know, was that kind of one-on-one relationship. And so I just took that into my solo and would find guys that I connected with and write that way. So I just recreated the same, you know, the same writing scenario. You know, now as I've gotten older, I love to collaborate with various people. Sometimes it'll be three guys in a room jamming. Sometimes it'll be four. And that's fun. And, you know, and moving to Nashville and writing here has really opened up, you know, my outlook and thoughts on songwriting and how to write songs, and love having as many. I mean, if there's six guys in a room, man, and we're all just like, hey, man, let's write a song, we'd do it, you know. And that's what I love about Nashville. And so, you know, it's changed in that regard, and I think it's changed in a good way.
Are you writing now?
Yeah, I'm writing now.
As
I'm actually leaving here
yep.
to go to a session to write for my next record.
Are you recording now?
No, just writing. I mean, I may record a demo if we finish something, you know, just to get the idea down. And what's funny is on my last solo record, a lot of those demo vocals that I recorded in that moment, at that time, same day, you know, within the 2 hours of writing the song, ended up being the final vocals. And I'm finding that doing that, sometimes you can't recreate the magic of that emotion that comes out in that moment. And so thankfully we record them, even when we're making the demos, we record the vocals like they could be,
right.
you know, final. And that's another Nashville thing.
As you start to do these solo shows, I mean, is Creed as a unit, will you guys ever play a band show again?
I don't know, man. I mean, I don't see why not.
But you're not broken up right now. You're just not together. Am I right on this?
I wouldn't say that we are broken up, no. I would say we are on an extended hiatus. You know, I've recently spoken with Mark and Flip, and you know, we stay in touch. Not like, I don't want to mislead anybody, you know, it's not like we're texting every day or calling every day, but, you know, we reach out on holidays and birthdays, and we have ongoing business that we handle.
But you wouldn't be opposed to ever getting back together again to play shows?
No, absolutely not.
So much money.
No, absolutely not. I'm not opposed to that at all. I mean, it just has to be the right time, and I think, you know, the right energy and vibe, and it has to be authentic and organic. And we all have to be in the right place to do it. And I think we're close to that. You know, like I said, I don't see any reason why that couldn't happen in the near future.
You know, when you see someone get so popular, it doesn't matter what it is, what if it's a writer or an artist. Like, I love Coldplay.
Right.
Coldplay's one of my favorite bands.
Yeah.
And the fact that people can hate on Coldplay just because they're so famous, it's like the platform continues to rise till so many people see you that you're just going to get enough haters.
Right.
I have to tell my fiance that now because she didn't want the public life at all.
Right.
But because she's with me, she now has 250,000 Instagram followers,
right,
and she's, people will come at her. She's like, I didn't do anything.
Right.
She's like, I don't want to, like,
right.
People are death threats, talking about how ugly she is, and she's not ugly at all, and she shouldn't be killed, you know? And so I'm like, you know, your platform, even though you didn't want it, has been raised,
right.
And so more people see you, more
right.
people get jealous.
Right.
You had to feel that at some point where you guys were so big.
I 100% felt that, And it hurt for a number of years. Once things turned from, you know, I'll never forget, you know, I've got an article framed in one of my rooms where I keep stuff, and it says, you know, Creed and Scott Stapp are this summer's rock and roll saviors. Okay, so we went from those type of headlines to literally, you know, the most hated band in America. And it was weird, like going from those two extremes. And it hurt because you didn't understand why. And it also, well, hey, that's not a part of what the rock and roll dream is supposed to be. Did that happen to Zeppelin? Did that happen to the Doors? Did that happen to U2? You start asking those questions. I'm not saying that we're in that category of those bands at all, but you know, we were a pretty big band at the time, and you know, and some of the hate, you know, I'm human, man, and you know, it hurt, and you know, and I took it personal for a number of years, and you know, and then there was a number of years where I got angry about it, and I'm the type of person that you know, gets angry and says, well, screw you, now I'm going to screw myself. And so instead of lashing out at them, I actually lash out at myself. So I began to self-sabotage. And, you know, and that's when I began to kind of, you know, when I would feel down and got into depression, began to, you know, drink and do things that would lead to behaviors that were very out of character for me when I was under the influence. And it was just self-sabotage, and it was dealing with almost being without, you know, I don't want to sound like a victim in any sense, but I felt, you know, it was kind of traumatizing, you know, to be so elevated and then to have such hate. And it wasn't so much that it was from the fans, because it wasn't from the fans, it was from the media. And so it was public and it was out there. And so it was embarrassing on one regard publicly, and then it hurt publicly. And then I contributed to that by my inability to handle that. I wasn't equipped emotionally or with the maturity, and did not have the people around me for support that I needed to advise me. You know, I'm sitting right here, and my publicist Tiffany is here. My God, had I had her in 1997, man, you know, had I had my wife Jacqueline, oh my God, had I had my wife Jacqueline in 1997 or 98, you know, so many things would have been different in my life. But you know what? I probably would not have Milan, my daughter. I probably wouldn't have Daniel, my son, or Anthony, my son. So things all happened the way they were supposed to happen, man. And, you know, of course, there are things that I wish I could do different and change. Definitely with how I handled certain things, how I handled some of the success, you know, with the over-partying and the overconfidence, and sometimes the ego getting out of control, you know, and which I, looking back and now having a 22-year-old son, I mean, that's part of being 22, 23, and 24. So, you know, he's not even, you know, playing arenas, and he deals with those issues. So imagine throwing, you know, money and on that. You know, I wish I could go back and be more mature and do those things. But you know, at this point in my life, man, it's all about peace and happiness and enjoying what you do, and all of those experiences that we just talked about, that you know, the good and the bad, have led me to a place today where, you know, I have an amazing wife and four beautiful children that I'm able to be a father to, and coach Little League and you know, go to recitals for my daughter and play guitar with my daughter. You know, my daughter's sitting in our music room and she's like, "Dad, check this out," and she's playing Arms Wide Open. And I'm like, "Oh, I can't wait to have you on stage with me playing that."
Of everything we talked about, what's funny is of all the success and the songs and the blah, 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 that where I saw you light up the absolute most was you talking about your kids.
Absolutely.
Of all the success and the money and the records and the deals, you're like, "Yeah, this is good." But when you were talking about your kids and your family, that's when your face, bing, went to a whole new place. Are you happy right now?
Absolutely. 100%. I'm happier today than I think I've ever been in my entire life. And that's the God's honest truth. I am a very, very blessed and fortunate man. I have an amazing wife. I have an amazing children. I have an amazing family. People that speak truth into my life to make me a better human being. You know, I couldn't ask for any more. And I'm thankful, so thankful and so grateful for the life that I was given, and for the fans and for the music industry that gave my music a chance and an opportunity. And all that has afforded me. I mean, I tear up, man, because I'm so thankful and grateful for all that, but also just to be here and to be able to sit in this moment here with you and talk about all this and reflect on it and realize, you know, what a blessing and a gift that it was, and just the opportunity that I get to continue to do this, man, with all these other blessings. I'm very blessed, and I hope that, you know, my story, you know, some of the stuff that we haven't touched on, I hope that my story and the music that has inspired and will continue to inspire can help someone else along the way, man. Because life is not all about me. It's about what I can give, and what I can share and how I can help others. And that's what I feel my purpose, is at this point in my life, aside from being a husband and a father.
Well, with that, I think we've done it all for today. Listen, this has been a thrill for me. We sat here for an hour. We didn't even scratch the surface. Listen, we could have done another hour, but you got to ride and I got to, you know. Yeah. But 6 months, 9 months, maybe a year, we'll do it again. You
Let's
get some
it,
more
man.
Music out. You want? You ready to put it out there?
Let's do it.
Come knock on my door. You know where I live now?
Yeah, man.
You come knock on my door.
I may be showing up. You're only like 8 miles from my house.
What? That would be the... We play basketball in the backyard. You still play ball ever?
I still play ball,
come
man.
On.
Let's
That's
do
what
it.
We gotta do.
Let's do it.
So, well, let me say that I know you don't do a lot of interviews. And so to come over and do this with me for an hour, it is just genuinely an exciting day for me. So thank you. I say that as sincerely as possible. I get to talk to everybody. I'll be honest with you. I'm pretty jaded at this point.
Yeah.
I don't give a crap. I'm like, it's part of my job. I talk to people.
Yeah.
Occasionally, you get that little like flutter again where you're like, oh, this is cool. Yeah. That was today for me.
Oh, thanks, man.
So I appreciate you and everybody who reached out to you saying I'm not a total tool. Like, I appreciate them, whomever they are.
No, everyone who reached out to me told me just how authentic and real you were. And man, I feel that right here in this room. I see it by looking at you, man. I've been around the block. So just like you, I'm jaded. And I get a vibe and a sense of somebody, you know, because we've met so many people in our lives that when we meet someone new and we feel their vibe, we've met someone like them before. You know what I'm saying? And you got great energy, man. And thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
My very final question, you can answer it with a word. Do people ever stop you at Walmart and go, hey, are you Scott Sapp?
Yes, they do.
Yes, they do. Because that wouldn't be me. I'd be like, oh, dude. I wouldn't even say hi. I would just take a picture from behind you and just be like, I'd post and be like, I think that's Scott Sapp. Listen, you guys can follow Scott. Go to his shows. He's at Scott Stapp on Instagram and TikTok. Creed Instagram is still, you guys are still, social media is still rolling.
Yeah, man. Yeah, man.
Accounts are still rolling.
Yes, they are.
Let's go.
Let's do it.
You heard it here. Let's go. I will be front row. All right. Scott, great to see you. Thank you so much.
Great to see you. Thanks for having me, Bobby.